From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, as well as next month's airing of Public Health Radio, our guest is Francis Moore LaPay. Over the last 30 years, Francis Moore LaPay has looked at the factors leading to hunger and malnutrition in the developing world, and also worked to promote farming methods that are sustainable to the environment and avoid dependence on pesticides, hormones, antibiotics, and other growth stimulants that may be harmful to human health and add to the debt burden and the disease burden of farmers. We'll be discussing her recent book, Hope's Edge, in which she traverses the globe looking at citizens and activists and farmers who have worked to eliminate hunger and foster community in both the poorest and the wealthiest countries. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. A study released last week by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration revealed that fatalities to motorcyclists increased sharply after a helmet law was repealed. The study compares data from 1998 nationally and in Florida to data collected in 2002, a year after the law was repealed. Researchers found that there was a 71% increase in deaths the year after the law was repealed compared to 1998, double the national increase. This sharper rise seen in Florida parallels the increase seen in the four other states which have repealed helmet laws. Helmet use declined from nearly 100% while the law was in effect to about 47% after the helmet law was repealed. Over three-quarters of the motorcyclists' head injuries reached costs of over $10,000, and many of the cases, about 20%, were funded through Medicaid and other public programs. The website of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is nhtsa.dot.gov. A report last week from the Mayo Clinic revealed that skin cancers among young women have tripled over the last 30 years. The researchers followed the entire population of Olmsted County, Minnesota, and includes nearly 500 cancer cases in those under 40 years old. The incidence of both of the common skin cancer types increased through the period. While these types of skin cancer are rarely fatal, they are significantly deforming, with well over half the tumors occurring on the head, face, or neck, and many of the cases required repeat procedures. The researchers hypothesized that these skin cancers are increasing in incidence due to a rise in sun exposure, greater use of tanning booths, and also due to the progressive depletion of the ozone layer over the 30 years since the study began. The study appears in the August 10th issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. In May this year, Representative John Shadegg of Arizona introduced a bill in the House of Representatives that would allow U.S. residents to purchase health insurance in any state. The bill is supported by several Republican governors and many Republican legislators across the country, and would go far to introduce more competition into the health insurance market. They view the proposal as utterly sensible, since it would allow residents to shop for insurance the same way they shop for consumer goods. A detailed analysis of the bill appears in the August 22nd issue of the New Republic. Jonathan Cohn, that periodical's senior editor, points out a number of problems with the proposed legislation that are not immediately apparent. First, he notes that health insurance is not just another sweater you can return to L.L. Bean if it arrives with holes in it. That if these policies failed to pay for health services, it would be nearly impossible for government regulators to help patients who are waiting for reimbursement from their insurance companies. He notes that the bill would likely flood consumers with new options, overwhelming the state insurance commissioners across the country who already can't keep up with their burden. Just in the last 2 years, over 50,000 residents of Florida and Texas were paying monthly premiums to scam companies that never paid for a single health service. The proposed bill would greatly augment the likelihood of similar insurance scams. Cohn also notes that the legislation would eliminate state regulations mandating certain services be covered, such as pap smears and breast cancer screening that many states currently mandate. But most ominously, the bill would leave some of the sickest residents with no choices at all for health insurance, since such policies are likely to exclude coverage for pre-existing conditions, and impose severe experience rating on individuals and businesses that purchase a policy and then file expensive claims. Cohn predicts that the result would be an increase in the already high rate of medical bankruptcy in the U.S., and would also add tremendous expense for state government Medicaid programs when the sickest individuals become more and more uninsurable and fall into the government safety net after exhausting their savings. The text of the proposed bill, H.R. 2355, is available through the House of Representatives website, house.gov. The website of the New Republic is newrepublic.com. A coalition of pharmaceutical companies has filed a lawsuit against the Bush administration, alleging that a Department of Defense plan to collect rebates for prescription drugs purchased by military personnel at retail pharmacies is illegal. The rebate program was designed in 2002 with the intent to ensure that drugs purchased by military personnel at pharmacies would have the same discount as drugs distributed through the Department of Defense hospitals and clinics. The program was implemented last year, and anticipating savings, lawmakers cut $172 million from the defense budget for fiscal year 2005. However, to date, the military has received less than 20% of the projected $300 million in rebates this year. Pharmaceutical industry officials have said that the plan is illegal because individual beneficiaries rather than the government are making the purchases. The lawsuit has implications for a Veterans Administration plan to implement a similar rebate program. If such a program were enacted by the VA, it would be vastly larger since there are many more veterans than there are active military personnel, and veterans, on average, are much older and sicker and use many more prescription drugs. This such a program might also relieve the burden on elderly and infirm veterans from having to travel long distances, in many cases, to VA facilities to receive expensive prescription drugs they would otherwise be unable to afford. Finally, last week the International Food Policy Research Institute released a report estimating that there are now 200 million malnourished individuals in sub-Saharan Africa, representing about 35% of the population. Just under 40 million of these are children. The report estimates that to cut malnutrition in half over the next decade, $300 billion in aid would be needed. There would be a need for improved crop, land, and water management, as well as better transportation and communication support. The report also called for the wealthy nations to drastically change their agricultural policies and liberalize trade in agriculture, providing better access to world markets for the poor countries in Africa and worldwide. The report is available at the Food Policy Research Institute's website, ifpri.org. And the issue of malnutrition in the less developed countries will be the major focus of today's show. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Over the last 3 months, the world has gradually come to realize that yet another famine is occurring. This one centered in Niger and the neighboring countries of West Africa. An assessment by the UN Food Program and UNICEF has estimated that 150,000 children will be dying there over the next 6 months, and another 650,000 will be stunted by severe malnutrition. A locust infestation and poor rain last year led to a poor grain harvest, and now people are dying. But is the story really so straightforward? In the U.S. and in other developed countries, droughts, floods, hurricanes, and other natural disasters occur with regular frequency, yet malnutrition and deaths don't result. 30 years ago, the Green Revolution, which introduced the use of fertilizers, pesticides, and other growth stimulants, was supposed to put an end to hunger and starvation in the poorer countries. Yet we still see both acute crises, as in Niger currently, as well as long-term malnutrition in many parts of the world. At the same time, in the U.S. and in other developed countries, highly refined, high-calorie foods have contributed to our current epidemic of obesity and diabetes, and runoff from ever larger farms is one of the primary causes of water pollution nationwide. And the long-term impacts of the use of antibiotics, pesticides, and genetically modified organisms are still unknown. Joining us to discuss these issues today, as well as on next month's show, is Frances Moore LaPay. Ms. LaPay has spent over 30 years exploring agriculture and hunger, and her work continues to influence the international debate on the root causes of hunger and poverty. Ms. LaPay co-founded the Institute for Food and Development Policy, which works on the causes and prevention of hunger, and she co-founded the Center for Living Democracy, which explores the relationship between democracy, power, and development. She currently works at the Small Planet Institute. Her recent work, Hope's Edge, is unique in that it goes beyond simply analyzing worldwide problems and focuses squarely on a diverse array of solutions to food insecurity that active citizens have been working on in countries across the globe. Frances Moore LaPay's books have been used in university courses in more than 50 countries, and most, including her recent work, Hope's Edge, are available at the website of the Small Planet Institute, smallplanetinstitute.org. Frances Moore LaPay, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you so much.
Now, your book, Hope's Edge, covers a tremendous amount of ground, but I'd like to start off today's interview by letting listeners know that many of your books not only include the ideas you're working on and the people you portray in your travels, but also you pepper many, maybe even most of your books with fabulous, really healthy recipes, which I've actually partaken of, and they're all wonderful, and I wanted to thank you for that, too.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, those are recipes from leading whole foods and vegetarian chefs all across the country who were so kind to contribute.
And also, and the world.
And the world, yeah. I was going to add, then there are people, you know, at the end of each chapter, I mean, to write Hope's Edge, we traveled on 5 continents, and we asked people to share with us what are their favorites from their own culture. So we also have some examples from the places we visited.
Now, I'd like to start out today's interview by briefly going further back in your career than the book Hope's Edge, which I want to mostly focus on today. Maybe your first book, I'm not sure, was Diet for a Small Planet.
Yes.
And in that book, you start with the notion that hunger and starvation are affecting perhaps a quarter of the world's population. Within the issue of hunger, you can be deficient in calories or vitamins or many different components. But one of the main limiting nutrients worldwide that leads to starvation is protein deficiency. And you point out in that book that protein is a nutrient that is, it's very scarce, yet it's often wasted with current agricultural practices. So I'm wondering if you would start off by telling the listeners what happens to much of the plant protein grown in the U.S. and even in some of the poorer countries, and why you view that as an issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was my wake-up call. This was the light bulb going on when I realized that the experts were telling me, the newspaper headlines were telling me in the mid-late 60s, that we're running out of food, and yet in my own modest study, I learned that one-third of the world's grain was going to animals, to livestock. And then I have seen over the years that that has now increased so that nearly one-half of the world's grain is going to livestock. And we here in the United States have come up with a feedlot system that reduces that going into livestock, so that what I'm saying is it takes now in the U.S. 16 pounds of grain and soy to produce 1 pound of steak. And the waste, therefore, is just unfathomable. I mean, it's enormous. And the reason that that evolved to this highly inefficient system, what I call a protein disposal system, is because people throughout the world are too poor to make a market demand on that use of that land directly. And so you have the illusion of all this cheap grain floating around in world markets, and those who are ready to profit on that, they see all that cheap grain and they say, how can we make something more costly from it, which is grain-fed meat? And that is what's happened since the 1950s. It's gone in the direction of feedlot production of meat, whereas throughout human history, animals took not feed, not grain, but they took grass and turned it into high-grade protein, whereas we have, as I say, turned livestock into protein disposals, taking millions of tons of grain and reducing its capacity to feed people.
And the alternative is grass-fed or pasture-fed beef or other animals as well.
And as I learned, the other part of the big awakening for me was the realization that human beings don't need meat at all anyway. That by eating a diverse plant-centered diet, one can get all the protein that one needs. In the United States, we eat about twice as much protein as our bodies can use. We do not store protein, so it's just completely wasted. And that was really a part of awakening for me. I'm not necessarily saying we all need to become vegetarians, even though I am a vegetarian, but the point is that we don't need meat, and overeating of protein has its health downsides as well.
So really there's two parts to that. One is the lack of actual need to eat animal foods, and the other is the issue that animals can actually grow by eating grass, which wouldn't waste all that protein. Was that the idea?
Exactly, and that's, of course, what they've done over eons of time. That was why we prized them, because they could take what we couldn't eat, grass, and turn it into a high-grade food that we could. So it's just this strange product. It's really an artifact or, you know, result of this bizarre economic notion that we live within, a certain kind of market that just keeps spinning so that it returns high wealth to those who already have wealth. And so the majority of people can't afford luxury products that, you know, are so wasteful as grain-fed meat. So it's not anything natural, is what I'm saying, this whole grain-fed meat phenomenon. It's highly inefficient and destructive.
But the advantage to farmers who use that technique is that the animals grow a little faster? Is that the idea?
Yes, of course, you know, because they're, in a sense, they're concentrated in these feedlots where they can't move around much, so they're not burning much energy themselves, and they're just loaded up with the grain and soy, and, of course, with antibiotics, growth hormones and things like this that then end up in the meat that Americans eat.
The next book of yours I read, which I believe might have carried the same title or a revision, but I'm not really sure of that. But at any rate, it revisited the issue of worldwide hunger. And you expanded your thinking at that point, pointing out that side by side with hunger and malnutrition, even in very poor countries, was either land that was being given to monocultures of even esoteric crops like strawberries or avocados grown exclusively for export, or even land that wasn't being used at all, that was owned by some distant landowner. And I'm wondering if you view that as an issue yet today.
Oh, it is a huge issue. in many parts of the world, and certainly in Latin America, where you still have so much hunger, and yet considerable land, that fertile land, often held by the wealthiest rural families, that is not growing food for the people who are hungry. So, yes, in many parts of the world, it is still a huge issue.
Moving on to Hope's Edge, in one of the early chapters in the book, you visited Brazil, and you there looked at the issue of underutilization or dysfunctional utilization of land. And in Brazil, that's evidently being challenged with the landless worker movement. And I was wondering if you could tell us what you found there.
Yes. In a way, Brazil was the last place that I would have expected effective land reform that is addressing this concentrated control over productive land by a handful of families, depriving hungry people of the resource they need to eat and feed their families. I would have expected Brazil to be the laggard in the world in addressing this problem. And yet, in part because of urban people also becoming outraged about this problem and seeing rural people flooding cities because they had no choice, they couldn't stay in rural areas because of the concentration of control over the land, and partly because of religious motivation, the Catholic social teachings and liberation theology, social movements began to grow in the 1980s that ended up changing part of the Constitution, or when a new Constitution was being written. Into that Constitution is a requirement that the government of Brazil is responsible for making sure that land that is not being used is transferred into the hands of those who will use it productively in order to meet the needs of hungry people. So that was a huge, huge opening for a genuine addressing of this problem. And so what emerged is what's called the Landless Workers Movement. MST is the acronym in Portuguese. And this is now the largest social movement in our entire hemisphere, that it has benefited about a third of a million families who received 15 to 17 million acres of land among them, creating new communities, organic farms in many cases, growing food that is without pesticides, and reducing the infant death rate. And infant death is one of the chief measures of malnutrition. So they've already had a huge impact in just 20 years on hunger. So we had to go see this movement. That was one of our key motivations for going to Brazil.
One of the striking elements in the story of that movement was how strongly those who were participating in it felt and come to believe that just having food and being able to feed their families was not enough to build a healthy community, but they felt that they had to go beyond that. And I was wondering if you could describe that in a little bit more detail.
Well, they realized, first of all, as a social movement, that they had to be addressing the longstanding, what they, in Latin America terms, is called neoliberal philosophy. The idea, basically, that whatever the multinational corporation chooses to do is automatically in the interest of all. And so they really have developed a very sophisticated educational and dialogue program in their communities throughout Brazil to begin to address the notion that whatever the corporate interests do is in the interest of the country, and really working to democratize the political system in their country, which had led then to the election of a worker to become president of their country who put hunger first, ending hunger as the top plank of his political program. The president of Brazil goes by the nickname Lula, and although many would say that he hasn't followed up as everyone had hoped, but nonetheless there are anti-hunger programs now throughout Brazil that did not exist before. Taking off from one of the other places we visited there, Belo Horizonte, which means beautiful horizon, the fourth largest city in Brazil, that declared food a right of citizenship and created all sorts of initiatives in this fourth largest city to make sure that everybody in the city had access to healthy food, not just any kind of food.
That was actually a very inspiring chapter. And I was wondering, if you could describe some of the strategies they used. And it was amazingly not costly. They didn't even spend that much of their budget on it. And it was very well thought out, determined. And if you think the techniques they came up with would be generalizable to even the U.S.?
Well, some of them are actually already underway here, a few. Let me just say that this shift of frame, shift of mental map, as we call it in the book, from food as just something that is like any other commodity, a toaster or a hairdryer, to that which is essential to life and therefore a human right, that shift in frame just unleashed creativity so that church groups and citizen organizations and unions and all sorts of folks came together and sat down with government liaison and, okay, how do we make sure that good food is accessible to every single citizen in our city? And so they came up with ideas, for example, like this, which could happen anywhere. They looked around and said, okay, where are some little plots of government, of city-owned land that's not being used, you know, say near a bus stop that the city owns, and why don't we make that available to local organic produce growers? They bring in the produce and they have to sell it at a price that the poor can afford, and in exchange, we charge them virtually nothing to use that plot of city-owned land. Now, here is a win-win because the local farmers we talked to who were coming into the city to sell their produce were thrilled, and they were making more money than they'd ever made in their lives because of the volume of their customer volume had so increased. And the people in the poor areas, the poor neighborhoods, were thrilled because they had healthy food for the first time that they could afford. So that's one example. Another is they created a big restaurant downtown called the People's Restaurant, which served thousands of meals a day in this big kind of open-air restaurant. And anyone can eat there. You do not have to prove that you're poor. But the lunches served there every day are, you know, something like a third or so of the market price for a full several-course meal. And so you have very poor families. You have some, we saw military people, some soldiers eating there, some elders who, you know, would come on the bus there every day for the social interaction as well as the inexpensive food. So that was another idea. One thing that they do is in the poor areas, they have in the bus stops a list of where is the cheapest place for the basic food commodities that a poor and working family would need to buy. So that, as you know, or some of your listeners would know, that in poor neighborhoods here in the U.S., you often pay more for food. So how do you keep that price gouging from happening? Well, one way in this city in Brazil is by posting where the cheapest food is. So that was another innovation. Yet another was that the city took the government money that was being provided for each school child in the city from the federal Brazilian government. It took that money, and instead of buying corporate processed food with it, they started buying healthy local food from local farmers, and immediately the nutritional value of the school food for the school children went up. So there were all sorts of, I mean, there were dozens of initiatives that came forth, and we were told by the local government that all of these programs cost the city 1% of the city budget, because the city's primary role was linking people rather than, you know, for example, my first story here about the city was the idea of linking local farmers with the consumers in the inner city by providing those plots of land. So that didn't really cost the city much at all, and yet it made a huge difference in ending hunger.
Now, throughout the book, as well as in Belo Horizonte that you just described, you repeatedly come back to the theme of connecting smaller scale local farmers to nearby urban areas and trying to create that connection. Do you view that as an important strategy to improve nutrition?
Yes, and not just nutrition, but also every other aspect of our health, in terms of when you think of how much our food now is transported over great distances, which then adds, of course, to the use of fossil fuel, which then adds to the greenhouse effect, adds to global warming. So by buying local and buying local food, the ripple effect is enormous. And the idea of the importance of keeping small family farmers in business can have great ripple effects. I know that today in rural America, where there is a decline, for many reasons, decline in family farming, that you have greater drug use by young people than you even have in cities. You have a suicide rate of farmers that is 3 times the national average. So by choosing local organic food, you're benefiting your body by keeping away that toxic burden of carrying pesticides, which now we all have in our bodies, but we can reduce that by buying organic. Buying organic local means that you can help to keep the family farmer in business, which keeps a thriving rural community alive and benefits, therefore, the not only physical but psychological welfare of those who are growing our food. So I think that this buying local organic is one of those personal empowering choices that we can make wherever possible. And the more we ask our local grocer for organic and for local, the more pressure there will be for that. And this is a very empowering choice.
As I was preparing for this interview, I continually ran into a problem of word definition. And that is what we should call traditional or standard agriculture. Now, at the grocery store nowadays, there's always a special section, usually fairly small, with organically grown produce. And that section is usually very specifically labeled organically grown. But the rest of the produce aisle isn't really labeled inorganic or full of chemicals or anything else. So customers at the store may assume it's grown in some usual or traditional way. Of course, there's no mention of antibiotics or pesticides that may be used in growing those foods. So I guess I'm wondering, what terminology do you use to refer to foods that are grown using the two very different approaches to agriculture?
One of my pet peeves is to walk into a supermarket and to see some food labeled conventional and other food labeled, now a small minority still, label organic. Conventional is to me such a huge misnomer, because if you think of our history, this is pesticide-laden food is hardly conventional. It is a radical break that is only a few decades old. And so I would say it is chemically dependent. And if those little labels in the supermarket, if it said pesticide sprayed instead of conventional, I think there might be a radical shift toward organic food. So I'm not sure what the best term is, but I like to think of what now is the majority of our agriculture here in the United States as chemically dependent, as extractive, because we are extracting topsoil to grow it, and certainly therefore not sustainable, whereas what we are moving toward, what is emerging, is what I would call ecological agriculture, because it is far more than simply the absence of pesticides. It is also based on greater knowledge of ecology, so that is based on knowing the interactions of plants with one another, different varieties of plants with one another, and with insects and microorganisms, on improved tilling practices. So it is really a positive scientific revolution as we gain much more knowledge of ecology. So I think the contrast I like to think of is the contrast between a chemically dependent extractive agriculture and a knowledge intensive and soil enhancing agriculture and health enhancing agriculture.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guest today is Frances Moore LaPay, and we've been discussing her recent book, Hope's Edge. After the break, we'll be looking at how agricultural policies in the U.S. and other developed nations impact environmental health and nutrition, and also malnutrition in the poor countries. We'll also be traveling to the Punjab province of India and taking a second look at the Green Revolution. So stay tuned. is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. My guest today is Francis Moore LaPay, author of over 15 books on agriculture, hunger, and sustainable development. And we've been discussing her recent book, Hope's Edge. I began the second part of today's interview by exploring the issue of agricultural subsidies and other agricultural policies in the wealthy countries. Now back to the interview. Since you've brought us back to the United States from Brazil, I'd like to stay in the U.S. and other wealthy countries, for that matter, and talk about the trajectory of agriculture in these countries. And you point out that this chemically dependent agriculture that we've come to use over the last 40 years or so is actually subsidized at least in two ways by government programs. And in the segment in the book on Europe, you get into even greater detail about a movement to oppose those subsidies. Maybe before we talk about that movement, could you talk about agricultural subsidies and why they are actually something that may be harmful? One would think that subsidizing agriculture would be a positive thing because it would reduce the price of food. But you point out in your book that that's by no means the major result.
Yes, well, certainly it makes a lot of sense for, in theory, for us as a people to say that agriculture, that is the basis of life, is worth our investing public resources in it. And if we were, in fact, investing our public resources in creating healthy food, that is, helping farmers shift toward these ecological farming practices and keeping rural communities alive to protect our soil and our wildlife and all of that, that would be a great use of public resources. But instead, we're spending something on the order of $18 billion a year to subsidize the largest commodity producers. Those are the big, like corn, cotton producers, for example, soybean producers. And the thing is, that $18 billion, three-quarters of that goes to the 10% of the very largest farmers in the United States, whereas the majority of farms get no subsidies whatsoever. And the primary beneficiaries of that great public purse of $18 billion of our tax money, the primary beneficiaries then are the processing companies, the companies that buy from the farmers, process that grain, and then the food manufacturers who turn that into processed food, because that is then their raw commodity that then they make chips from, and they make sugared cereals, which are then the high profit items for them, these highly processed foods. So it is a sense, a way that our tax dollars are going to subsidize some of the wealthiest corporations in America rather than the family farm.
But you point out that there are even other harms that these subsidies do. They promoting agricultural techniques that you already point out are depleting soil, and the pollution from the types of farms that receive these subsidies.
Well, yes. I mean, since these subsidies are not based on any value judgment about ecological farming practices, and the farmers are just going for the most immediate, quickest, highest yield and sold the chemicals to do that and propagandized through advertising to apply ever more pesticides and chemical fertilizers, then you have a situation, as we do today, where farming then becomes one of the biggest environmental threats. For example, the runoff of nitrogen from our farms in the Midwest has so filtrated into the Mississippi River, flows into the Gulf of Mexico, where it's created a dead zone periodically every year, an area in the Gulf of Mexico that where sea life is killed, that is as large as the state of New Jersey. So these subsidies are going to farms that are on this chemical treadmill there, because there's no criteria for using ecological practices, which of course would make tremendous amount of sense. If they're getting public subsidies, you would think that one of the first things that you would have to require is that recipient do no harm to the public. And yet look what's happening. the public waterways in the Midwest. There are a huge portion of our wells now in the Midwest are undrinkable because of nitrate in the water from fertilizers. So these are issues that have been right at the forefront of reform efforts in Europe, but are still just barely beginning here, where Europeans have said that the whole subsidy question has to be reexamined and that our subsidies should be oriented toward creating healthy rural communities and of soil and water, and not just to subsidize production, because that then just subsidizes the destruction of our farm resources. So that total reorientation of what we're subsidizing is still an issue that is yet to be joined here in the United States.
So far you've pointed out the harmful effects of current agricultural subsidy programs within the wealthy countries that have those policies. But you also point out in the book an idea that fascinated me, that after we subsidize crops such as, say, corn or wheat, that artificially lowers their prices, these crops are crops that the farmers in the poor countries can no longer compete with. And then their taste actually changes.
Yes. This is the other piece that Americans need to understand. When we think of images, say, of Africa, we've seen a lot of recently in the news over the last year, and we've seen a lot of images of poverty in Africa, the devastation of AIDS in particular and other diseases like malaria, but also images that portray Africa as resource poor, as poverty stricken because it lacks physical resources to feed itself. What is missing from that picture is that our subsidized exports of, say, a product like cotton, for example, directly undercuts the much more efficient, in terms of the lower cost production, of cotton growers in West Africa, for example, who can't make a living to buy the food they need because U.S. exports of cotton in the world market are undercutting them. Our exports are undercutting them because they are subsidized, not because our farmers can produce at a cheaper price. So these images of Africa of being poor because of natural causes of lack of fertile soil misses this more insidious aspect that our tax dollars are actually impoverishing these people, and it, in many cases, nothing to do with their physical lack of soil, but rather the lack of markets that are taken away from them because of our subsidies. And then you mentioned how tastes have changed. Well, starting way back, you know, at least in the 60s, I'm not sure when it began, but when I started looking at this in the 70s, it was a practice where our subsidized exports of wheat, for example, to Africa, were shifting markets away from the local grains, the millets and root crops that Africa evolved eating that were very drought resistant and suited to local soils, and got people eating white bread. Now, when I was in Kenya a few years ago riding Hope's Edge with my daughter Anna, we were served white bread, which, you know, is really lacking in nutrition, which is very costly import. Nothing to do with African traditions, but taste had shifted over in part because of advertising that said, you know, eat wheat and your children will be smarter, this sort of thing. So it's very, very insidious and profoundly distorting to the progress of a region of the world, to divert them away from what their natural habitat would best provide them. And this is in part subsidized by our tax dollars. This is greatly ironic and very sad.
I love the quote from Wangari Maathai, who said that colonialism provoked Africans to consume what they don't produce and to produce what they don't consume. And I think you've just gave an example of that.
Yes, exactly.
Another way that taxpayer money in the U.S. especially, and in other wealthy countries, is subsidizing current agriculture is in the how money is spent in agricultural research. And I was amazed when you point out in your book that less than 1% of the agricultural biotech budget looks at the potential risks. And almost the whole budget is directed toward this chemically dependent agriculture. Do you know if there's efforts in this country to change that?
There are. I mean, this is, I mean, one of the things I hope that our listeners will grasp is while I'm talking about the problems, actually, a huge portion of my own life's work is to focus on what is emerging that the media isn't covering that is part of the solution. And so I'd like right now to mention our website, which is smallplanetinstitute.org, which is very much oriented toward what is evolving that are the solutions. And in Hope's Edge, I want to underscore in the book Hope's Edge that we have a big section there of what we call entry points, organizations that are directly addressing every single problem that you and I are talking about today. And certainly in this area, that there's a huge movement. Organic Consumers Association comes to mind, and in our book, you can find that, of course, on the web, and in our book we mention that and many others. So that the great thing is that there is now just a huge upsurge in the last 10 years of citizens' movements that are taking on these core questions and to democratize our food system, both access to food as well as standing up to the biotech industry and saying no, that this risky technology is not warranted. There is no excuse for taking unknown risks with our lives because we know how to grow food healthfully. I almost hate to get into debates about the degree of risk involved in biotechnology, genetically modified organisms, because in my book, since there is no reason to take even a tiny risk, that I don't want to debate how great the risks are, because there's no point in risking anything in terms of biotechnology, because we know how to produce enough food for us all without any of that risky technology, which is making genetic transfers in a way that nature would never have allowed, and therefore risking all sorts of proliferation of plants, which we have no idea what the consequences will be for ecology, for our plant ecology, and for our own bodies. So absolutely, there is my real point here is there is a movement, a huge movement, to not only resist, but to show what a ecological agriculture and ecological eating looks like for the good.
Since the book Hope's Edge, which is the primary focus of today's interview, since in this book, you and the readers travel quite a bit, let's right now travel. Let's go to India for a moment, and I'd like to introduce your segment on India by reminding listeners that around 30 years ago, right around the time you began publishing, universities in the U.S. were touting this green revolution that was supposed to solve the problem of hunger in the developing world. And you never really bought into that, and you've been a critic of that really pretty much from the start. And I'd like to have you describe what is meant by the green revolution, and then what your thoughts are on these kinds of high-tech strategies in terms of solving malnutrition.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, we have been, in a sense, talking about it without using that name. And the green revolution, well, let me just say that when I began this path that I'm still on, clearly, I was a young woman in my 20s, and it was really the early days of what became called the Green Revolution, which meant the application of, first of all, the introduction of hybrid seeds. This is before biotechnology, but the breeding of seeds for higher yields. But what the higher yields were really not independently higher yields. They were dependent on greater applications of chemicals and greater access to irrigation. So they were higher responding, in the sense, seeds that then called for greater protection from chemicals and greater water. So those who could take advantage of them were the better off farmers. And so that in itself led to increasing concentration of ownership of land and wealth in, say, a country like India. So here's the thing. Those defenders of this revolution say, look what happened. There was this explosion of yield and greater production in a country like India, and so they didn't have to import grain any longer. What a success. How could you, Francis Morlapay, ever criticize this thing called the Green Revolution, because it clearly succeeded in averting hunger by creating greater yields? Well, my response to this is that, you know, every choice we make in life is a choice not to do something else. You know, we all know that. And what I'm saying is that, yes, no one can argue but what this greater application of chemicals and irrigation, no one can argue that it did not create higher yields, you know, more production in a country like India. But what I'm saying is that also it foreclosed on another option, which was to move in the ecological direction of focusing on how do we improve yields while respecting our relationship with the earth by refusing to become chemical dependent and risking all of the downsides of pesticide use. And we haven't even talked yet about the risk of monoculture that is wiping out the biodiversity around the world. It was a choice, in other words, not to go in the direction of ecological farming, which even the poor farmer could incorporate into his or her practices. And instead, it went in the direction of this chemically dependent approach, which relied on purchased inputs, as they're called, that only the better off could afford, which then led to the consequence of greater concentration of wealth in the countryside. So my stance has always been not that we stand still, because that's not what human beings do, but at every crossroads we have to look at down those roads that we are taking and say, was there an alternative, and is there an alternative today that is less risky and has a chance of creating a more healthy community overall, and not just higher production. As you know, in Hope's Edge, you know, Marvin, we talk about the focus on just this narrow production focus, and that is what is the downfall here. We have to look at the overall health of communities.
When you were visiting Punjab, this was much more recently, this was in the last few years, apparently the initial, what appeared to be initial benefits from Green Revolution were now pooping out, and they were now getting into various problems. And I was wondering if you could describe that as well as the movement there.
Yeah, this was one of the more dramatic moments in our trip, actually. We were in India to look at the positive things were emerging, but we also got to take a side trip to what is known as the breadbasket of India, the Punjab. And there we met farmers. We in a gathering, I remember, I'll never forget as long as I live, about 40 farmers gathered around my daughter and me with a tape recorder and translators, and these were Sikh farmers, so it was visually very dramatic because they were all dressed in their turbans in different colors, but the distress on their faces, the anguish, the fear, and the passion with which they communicated their experience to us, it was just almost overwhelming. They described how they'd been encouraged to buy the imported seeds and to buy the fertilizers and chemical pesticides and to go in that direction. And then a few decades later, realizing that they were heavily, heavily in debt and that chemicals were no longer working, they were no longer protected from pests, and they were losing their crops to pests. The pests had bred resistance to the chemicals that were being applied, and they were really at the point of banks foreclosing on them, as many, many were facing foreclosure. Suicide rates were skyrocketing and have in India among these small farmers. So it is this process of the chemical treadmill, where once you start applying the chemicals, then the pests gain resistance to those, so you have to apply more and more. And also the irrigation that these crops required led to a waterlogging in many of these regions in the Punjab, and so the soil was no longer fertile because it became too saline, too much salt, as the water was over-irrigated for too long. So there are other problems like this, and it was desperate. It was a desperate situation. And so this calls us back to this larger question of the more sophisticated approach of ecological farming. So when I just want to stress then that when you hear the term organic farming, this is not going backward. This is going forward to the understanding that is much more sophisticated than pesticide-dependent farming. Pesticide-dependent is a very simplistic way of just kind of firing the gun, if you will, at the problem, rather than a more sophisticated seeing the interactions of plants with the soil and with other plant varieties and water. So what those farmers we met in the Punjab, they were the victims of this very simplistic propaganda that all you need, right, is to throw more chemicals and to throw the imported seeds at a problem, rather than really helping them to work with their own ecological resource.
And then the movement you visited there, or think tank, I'm not sure what exactly it was, but they were actually, one of their main goals apparently was just to re-educate farmers about how to go back to more sustainable techniques. Isn't that
yes,
correct?
Yes, and it was so exciting. Then I got to go back then a few years later to see the progress. And yes, it is both a think tank and a movement. So you were right in when you said each, because it is a think tank and a resource center with scientists working on improving yields using ecological approaches, and they work directly with farmers.
What was the name of this movement?
Navdanya, which means nine seeds. Navdanya. So they work with farmers, and we met at that time a few thousand farmers, not that we met them all, but the movement included a few thousand farmers in the foothills of the Himalaya, and we got to meet some of them. And when I went back then 2 years later, that had grown to 20,000 farmers who are now giving up the chemical approach, that, and they themselves talked to Anna and me about the damage to their bodies, the illnesses that had resulted from using pesticides, and now they're so delighted to go back to sharing of seeds, using saving seeds from harvests, and then sharing the best of those and working with the scientist in this resource center right there at the foothills of the Himalayas, and building their own agriculture up based on their local resources instead of being dependent on imports. And so it was quite an inspiring story. So this is, of course, happening not just in this spot in the foothills of the Himalaya near Dehradun in India, but on every place we visited, there is such a movement of farmers who are saying no to a dependent style of farming and yes to this more locally self-reliant approach to farming.
Well, Frances Moore-LaPay, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
What a pleasure it's been for me. It's just a great opportunity, and thank you for what you do.
On next month's show, Frances Moore-LaPay will be joining us again. On that show, we'll be looking at the special role women play in community empowerment and development, and also discuss her view on how globalization relates to sustainable development and public health. To learn more about agriculture, development, and hunger, I recommend the website of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, foodfirst.org. Listeners who would like to purchase Hope's Edge or access Frances Moore-LaPay's other writing can go to the website of the Small Planet Institute. That web address is smallplanetinstitute.org. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.